Welcome, folks, to episode 3509 of the Survival Podcast. I'm going to have Nick Ferguson on with me in just a minute. Had I booked him one day later, it would have been 3510, and that would have just been cooler for some reason. I don't know why. I just like numbers. But this idea came up from a multifaceted thing. One is Nick answered a question on fodder for fuel forest permaculture, basically, for fuel and fodder last week on the Expert Council show. And that kind of merged into a thought process I've been going through with all of these people that tell me, man, I got this idea. Me and all my friends, we're going to buy some land and we're going to grow all our food. We're going to bring in this military guy to teach us how to defend ourselves. And we're just going to live off grid and not worry about anything. And the first thing I think when I hear this is, number one, you're going to starve. Number two, it's not going to work. Number three, if you do enough of this military shit, you might get koreshed. But if you actually wanted to pull that off, if you actually wanted to get a group of families together, live on a piece of land, and actually at least take care of the concept of feeding yourself, would you be able to do it with potatoes, carrots, and corn? Or might there be a better way? Because we do have the tagline, there is a better way to do this. Personally, I think the better way to do this is silvopasture and grazing. And if we do that, we can actually produce enough kilocalories to feed everybody, and then everything else gets easier. Because once you know you're going to eat, you're going to be okay. So I reached out to Nick and said, hey, man, you want to come on air and talk about this? And he was like, I'm down. So we set up the time. That's what we're about to do. Before we do that, though, let's take care of our sponsor. Sponsor of the day, number one today, Start 9 Embassy Service. You know, we talk a lot about sovereignty. Today is really a food sovereignty show. But what about your digital sovereignty? If all of your information is being housed in the cloud on Google Drive or Amazon Web Services, or you're using Gmail or something like that, guess what you're doing? You're using somebody else's computer. There is no cloud. All those instant messages you guys are bouncing back and forth between your friends talking about things like food sovereignty and other things, that's straight to the government, straight to marketing agencies. What if you could make that all go away? What if you could run your own Bitcoin node, your own Lightning node, your own messaging services, your own data storage, and you could access it from anywhere in the world over the Tor network so that it's all completely private? What if all your messaging could be end-to-end encrypted? I'm talking actual military grade, not some made-up marketing term bullshit that just, if we say that term, people will like it. You can do all of that and more very simply with Start 9. If you can plug a couple cables in and operate a smartphone, you can use it. Check them out today at start9.com. Next up today, hey, you're going to go out and feed yourself off your land. It won't do you a lot of good if you drink nasty water and you end up dying of diarrhea, which is one of the number one causes of death in the world after disasters, by the way. You can make that all go away with a Berkey filter. The best place to get a Berkey system or filters for your existing system, usaberkeyfilters.com. Check them out. That is Jeff, the Berkey Guy Gleason. Been supporting this show since 2010. That's 14 years, still around. So he isn't going anywhere. One of the top Berkey dealers in the world. So if there is a problem, he can call the mothership and get it fixed. Check him out today. Again, usaberkeyfilters.com. With that, I want to bring our guest on today, expert council member and my good personal friend, Nick Ferguson. Nick, welcome to the show, bro.
Good to be here as always.
Real quick reminder, as Nick and I get started, if you want to ask us a question or give us a talking point, even if it's a talking point, it'll just make it easier. The word question in all caps in the live chat, then your question or talking point. That way I'll start. And with Nick here, I'll probably actually see it today, too, because I don't have to stand here and monologue for an hour and a half. So anyway, Nick, let's start off with you heard the intro. You were in the virtual green room or whatever you want to call it. I mean, what are your thoughts on when you hear someone make that off-the-cuff remark, man, we're going to get everybody together, we're going to grow all our own food, and you know they're talking about like a vegetable garden and all. And I know you and I are not opposed to gardening. We teach that is a critical skill. I want some vegetables next to my ribeye. But I also have this like impending feeling of doom for these people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so everything looks better through rose-tinted glasses, you know? When you haven't done something, the idea of it and the romanticized notion always sounds so much better than when you actually try to do it. And, you know, I think about how much effort I have put into gardening over the years as compared to I get my fencing set up and those animals are doing the work for me and I just pick the time when I harvest them. And in the meantime, they're just growing and harvesting all of the food for me. You know, I can even, I can't call that row of potatoes and say, come on, come over here and hop in the bin for me. I can do that with sheep and goats though. So yeah, whenever I hear that, I think, no plan of action survives contact with the enemy. And the enemy in this case is real life. And, yeah. And real life can be an absolute bitch. So
reality is Macho Man Savage coming off the top turnbuckle with an elbow to the head, except it's real. It's not 1980s wrestling. That's what reality is. Ooh, yeah. Boom.
Uh-huh.
Like, just right between the freaking eyes.
Yeah, and reality's not going to be pulling any punches for you. So
No. As I said, it's not the thump slap where it's not real. Like, it's the full-on Hacksaw Duggan metal chair to the back. And I do get the feeling, and you kind of alluded to this when you were talking there, that most of the people that say this have never actually grown food before. Mm-hmm. Because if they had, they would realize that the statement they're making – and I want to be clear, from the context that they're coming at it with is preposterous.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Can you grow all of your own food? Absolutely. But if you've never done it before, do not expect to, you know, as soon as things hit the fan, you're just going to take your seed bank that you've had stored in your closet for the last 5 years and start growing a garden. When there's no preparation, you don't have things ready to go, you've never done it before, there is a learning curve to gardening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even good gardeners would understand you're probably not, like, if you put, let's say, something not huge, six families, average size, four people, onto a piece of land, something reasonable for that, 25 acres is way more than you need. If you're going to try to do that with gardening and you're moving onto a new piece of land that hasn't ever been cultivated before, mm-hmm. and you've got to start with, you know, nasty clay soil or caliche or who knows what, even good gardeners are not going to generate enough calories early on or even, you know, a couple of years in to feed people straight off vegetation. It's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
Our grain crops are what feeds the world, our grain and our legumes like soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And those are done at massive industrial scale. And I personally believe that's the only way we're able to feed so many people with them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've got a tremendous amount of energy, embodied energy in the fuel consumption, the fertilizer usage, and the equipment itself. You take those things out of the equation, and man, the amount of labor and effort that it would be required to do that, to replace all that stuff, is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, that's where I want to say a little bit on behalf of the establishment, even though I hate them. If we go back to before we had all this mechanized equipment, we had all these herbicide-resistant things and herbicides to use. We had all this, you know, high application rate fertilizer. The average farmer family was probably farming 20 to 40 acres, if that.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire growing season, not plant and harvest, the entire growing season was back-breaking labor of cultivating, weeding, because by the time you got through a weeding pass on 20 or 40 acres, well, then everybody just goes back to the beginning and does it again. And they did that from planting time all the way through to harvest. So when you think you're going to get your 18 buddies together or whatever and your Navy SEAL buddy who doesn't know anything about growing a turnip and go grow enough food to feed a family with, I just don't think it's going to work. And I had a little conversation with ChatGPT about just straight caloric yield mm-hmm. to help people get their head around this. So I asked ChatGPT, and I'm sure these numbers are lower because they won't fully utilize an animal the way that you and I or a lot of people in this audience would, where we tip the tail. But a beef cow, average size, once processed, will yield about 630,000 calories. That's enough to feed a family for a year. If you want to grow potatoes, which are like a standard calorie crop, that's why I did that, 5,727 potatoes to equal one cow in calories with nowhere near, well, I'm not even getting into nutrition. I'm just raw energy at this point. For a lamb, an average lamb at harvest weight will yield 66,300 calories. You want to grow potatoes to equal one lamb, 603 potatoes. A pig, you'll get 175,500 calories based on a harvest weight of, I did 250 pounds because pigs are all over the map. Number of potatoes needed, 1,596. Now, if you want to feed 10 families, 6 families, just multiply those numbers by that. And that's, I'm just going to say it's a lot of potatoes, bro. And then what happens when potato blight comes? Ask an Irishman. Mm-hmm. And again, before we shift into solution here, I want to restate for anybody, especially if you don't know Nick and I, you found this podcast, you know, somewhere down the line. We are not anti-garden. I know I already said it, but I'm going to say it again before we turn the corner here. We're not anti-growing things. I was out in my garden today picking mouse melons and kikuzu squash and stuff like that. But we're just making the point that if your goal is food sovereignty, you're probably going to need a greater yield than you're going to get out of gardening or even small-scale farming in the vegetative sense. So I've got notes here for you that were prepared for this. You did a great job, by the way. Thanks for doing my work for me. But what we're saying here is, like, a really great solution to look at would be silvopasture and grazing. Can you start out with just helping people understand, what does silvopasture mean? Does it mean we put a bunch of silver hanging from the trees and tinsel or something? Exactly. There's another explanation for that, right?
Yeah, silvopasture is to paint the picture. Just about everybody has seen some documentary or some movie, and you've got the, you know, it's a pastoral scene. It's England, you know, World War II era or previously, you know, maybe Victorian era. And you've got these trees dotting this beautiful field. It's all green. There's sheep or cattle underneath the trees grazing. That is silvopasture. It's trees over a pasture. And there is, you know, a lot of those scenes, it's just going to be like, it's an old oak tree that was just growing there and the farmer just worked around it, or they were just really pretty trees, so they just left them. But we can get really, really, we can kind of min-max this kind of game. And we can choose the things that are going to grow in those spaces instead of just letting nature just decide whatever it wants. And that's where it gets really interesting, when we can start picking and choosing what we're putting into these silvopasture systems. So what the goal is with the silvopasture system, there we go, is we're trying to advantage the entire ecosystem. We don't want just a monocrop of grass, because what we end up with is very little edge. And in those edges between different elements and different systems interacting with each other, we get a tremendous amount of stability and variability. So when we have variable and stable systems, we end up with systems that can bob and weave through climatological changes, through just, you know, weather disruptions. You know, if it's, we have a really hot, dry summer versus a really wet summer and cool summer, if we have a lot more variability and edge in our system by design, then what we end up with is an ecosystem, because that's what we're dealing with. We're designing ecosystems here. If this silvopasture is a varied, resilient system, it can be very productive in cool, moist summers or hot, dry summers. if we have something that's monocropped and it's just grass, there's no shade, and we have a really hot, dry summer, well, you end up with situations like what happened in Texas not too many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute drought, and I mean,
massive grass fires,
and the ranchers were having to completely cull their herds down to the absolute bare minimum.
Yep.
And that's really hard.
Yeah,
and that'll put a real, real damper on the survivability of your family if you're going at this from a much smaller perspective and a much smaller land holding. There's a whole lot less less wiggle room or room for error when it's just you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, just for people to get in their head how intense these fires were, like I saw one image, a telegraph pole, the big ones, burnt through, hanging by the lines. That's nature's blowtorch, buddy. I don't know if you've ever burnt an old telephone pole, but it's an effort to burn through one. The intensity of that heat had to be absolutely insane. And the other thing I want people to focus on as we dig into this is what we're doing from, let's say, a regen ag or permaculture standpoint is we're always looking to nature and say, how do we create an analog to what natural systems are doing, but in a way where we can control the result? So if we look at that and say, what are the most productive terrestrial ecosystems on the planet? There's no comparison. It is savanna ecosystems.
Yep.
Which is trees and plains together. Mm-hmm. And when we do this, we're simply saying, instead of having a little spot of trees here and a little spot of trees here and a little spot of trees here, let's put the trees where they do us the most advantage and they do the animals the most advantage at the same time. So more trees, but still we're open enough to allow for good grazing. And to me, the only thing you should have to do, unfortunately, it takes more effort, but the only thing you should have to do to convince a cattle rancher or a sheep rancher or what have you that this is the way to go is take them out to their own field. And like you said, sometimes there's this really nice tree that they leave behind. Mm-hmm. They have their cattle. They're not shifting them the way that we would. They're just letting them go. And underneath that tree, out to the edge of the drip line and a little past it, there's not a speck of grass. It's all completely gone and denuded. And all the cattle in the middle of the day are sitting up there in the dirt, laying there or standing there in the shade. Why? Because it's freaking hot out, and it sucks. If you were covered with hair, you'd go there too. Hell, I'm not covered with hair. Well, my wife says I am, but I would go there, right? So if the cows all love that one tree, what if you gave them 1,000 trees and laneways to graze in? Well, then they might actually move around and not completely destroy the ground under the tree. Because I've literally had farmers tell me, well, they ruin anything under a tree. Well, they have 2 on 20 acres. I guess they do, right? Like, what we're doing, savanna mimic is what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah, and I love seeing those light bulb moments when people come to your workshops, and it's at the end of the season, right? It's been a tough summer, and this is one of my favorite things is when we're doing a walk and talk. And we get out there, and they're looking around at the forbs and the grasses underneath the trees, and they notice the difference, and they say, that's what – look how green it is here, and it's brown over there.
Brown over there, yeah.
Right? And it's a line.
Yeah.
It's a line just around that tree in the shadow of the tree. And around that drip line, it's green.
Yep.
And they say, oh, so this is why it's a good idea. If it was, you know, if it was going to cut down on the amount of grass I could grow, well, if the goal was to cut down on the amount of grass, then we should have no trees. Because everyone thinks, well, it needs all the sun. Well, that's largely from a lack of understanding in how photosynthesis happens.
Along with our friends from government, because I've talked to ranchers, Kansas, Nebraska, et cetera, and they literally say, kill a tree, save a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
They make a direct correlation that the more trees you kill, the less water the trees will need, and therefore the more water you'll have for your pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just look at that and go, so you don't know anything about a hydrological cycle at all, and the person from NRCS or FDA or whoever's talking to you also knows nothing about hydrological cycle. You guys don't know that as we cut forest for mine timbers in the 1800s, that they watched the creeks dry up as they cut the trees down.
Yep.
And there is nowhere in nature that this works naturally, like just destroying everything except grasses and expecting to maintain that system in grass. That's not a thing. Even the Great Plains had lots of trees. Mm-hmm. They just weren't forested. They were in, again, a savanna style mm-hmm. dispersion pattern. And the animals probably created their own laneways. Because if it's hot as heck out, and I'm a buffalo, covered in this woolly fur stuff,
mm-hmm.
there's a line of trees along the creek, and I can meander my big ass through there in the shade, or I yep. can go out in the middle of the field where I'm far more exposed, my calves are more likely to get taken by wolves or natives or whatever. I'm probably going to stick to the edge because I don't know, Nick, haven't you heard this before, that abundance is always on the edge?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's what we're doing. We're creating edge. As we do that, let's talk about some of the livestock that we would use. Let's start off with the ones that, in my opinion, produce the most amount of yield for us with the least amount of effort, and those being the ruminants. You want to kind of walk us through some of those?
Yeah, yeah. So whenever I'm talking with my clients about, because this is a question that always comes up, what kind of animals should I be raising? Well, it comes down to, are you looking for the highest yields that you can possibly achieve, or are you looking for the lowest management inputs? The lowest stress, if you will, the easiest thing or the most pounds of meat I can possibly get off of this land, or the most hours I can be devoting to something else. Because a lot of these people, we've got a full-time job, a full-time plus outside employment, and I just don't have the time to devote to shifting around sheep or goats or whatever. So if the goal is I want to just, I don't have time to think about it. I don't have time to deal with the predator issues. I need some meat yield off of this property. Then if we're talking about ruminants, then we're going to shift directly to cattle because, you know, a big cow is just not going to get bothered by neighbor dogs. A cow can just kill it really easy with a quick kick. And frankly, most canines are intimidated by a 1,000-pound animal.
Yeah.
Or 1,000-pound plus.
As so, they should be.
Right. Right. They're big, scary critters. So cattle are going to be the easiest. They are, you know, conversely, they are going to be one of the more dangerous animals on your property just because they're big. More people die every year from cattle than most any other animal in the USA.
Really?
I mean, yeah, look at the stats on them. Cows, just a friendly cow that loves you to death, just steps wrong and hits your foot. And yep. crushes the bones in your foot just because, oops, that's, I'm just walking around. You know,
I'll add to that one of the most high probability fatal injuries is a broken femur. You know, we think about people breaking bones all the time and said, mm-hmm. not when you break a femur bone, you can bleed to death internally very, very quick. Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. And so again, say the cow accidentally knocks you over and walks on mm-hmm. your leg.
Right.
You know,
right. Or it's a mama cow and you got too close to her baby and yeah. she's just protecting her baby and she views you as a threat and she knocks you over and starts stomping on you.
And they'll do it.
Yeah, they will do it.
We'll do it.
So if it's hands off kind of perspective, cattle, man, you can just walk away from it as long as they have forage to eat and they have water and they have secure fences, you could walk away for months and just come back and they're fine. Yep. They're just doing their thing, eating yep. grass and laying in the shade and chewing their cud. So
in your notes, you have they're the safest, but when you say safest, you mean for them. Like yeah, you don't need tyranny to protect the cow because the cow will protect a cow.
Right. Safest investment.
Yeah. Okay.
right. So if I'm dumping $2,000 into cattle, and I'm going to be really hands off, my safest investment is probably going to be cattle. If I'm dumping $2,000 and I'm going to be hands off, and I dump $2,000 into sheep, I'm probably going to be losing quite a bit of that investment, because we can just, you know, segue right into sheep here. Mm-hmm. A lot of sheep farmers that I know, sheep ranchers, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
They say sheep want to die and goats want to make your life hell.
truth to and, that.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to it, and yeah. And this is coming from people that raise both of them. So when it comes to, you know, the most productivity from the numbers that I've been able to look up, white papers I've studied, and actual producers doing it day in and day out, people that have done meat goats for years and years and years, and they shifted to sheep. And then they're shifting right back to meat goats. You know, it's people that have been doing this for decades and decades that I'm getting a lot of this information from. So firsthand experience that I'm getting to learn from. And they tell me, you know, sheep want to kill themselves. They're kind of a pain in the rear. But if you're on top of them and you're taking care of them, and you have good systems set up, you have good protections in place with livestock guardian dogs, then sheep are pretty much one of the most highest producing as far as meat yield and a lot of times dollar amount, larger ruminant that you can possibly have on your property.
I think they're fantastic, but they do, as you mentioned, come with some challenges. And one is, you're going to have to make the investment in guardian dogs. And notice I didn't say guardian dog. I said dog-ass. Because if you put one even well-trained guardian dog out on a pasture like that, where you're not there all the time, and that's why the dog is, because you're not, then coyotes will lure that dog out, gang up on that dog and kill each dog. Then they'll eat all your sheep.
Yep.
When you have two dogs, and it takes time to train them not to go out and pursue. And as you develop that, like, you have to keep bringing in young dogs, because the young dog wants to do that. And the older dog's like, bro, no, we stay here.
Right.
Right. Because that's what they'll do. They'll even send females in that are in heat and they'll take that tail around and they'll lure that dog out. And then what I learned from Greg Judy is there were people saying all of a sudden the dogs turned on, the sheep started eating the sheep. Well, it's because they're hands off. They're putting kibble out for the dog. Freaking sheep eat all the kibble. Sheep apparently love kibble, and once they know it, they'll eat it first before anything else. And then when there's no food for the dog's like, well, he looks pretty good. I know, I'll just eat one. But then it's like Lay's potato chips, right? So now the dog develops a taste for the thing it's supposed to be protecting. So you, like what I saw Greg do, which was pretty cool, he has these things that almost look like live catch traps. Yep. And the food for the dogs goes in those, and then the dog can get in there, but the sheep can't. But like you just said, that's all more stuff that you have to do. And I would say that all that dog monologue there, that applies to goats too. I mean, a coyote will take a goat out, right? So both of those with that, where again, the cow doesn't have that issue.
Right. Yeah. The cows are a lot more hands off. The sheep and goats, there's more of a learning curve, but there's more productivity to it. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot more pounds of meat out of a piece of property with sheep or goats than you can with cattle. It's just that's how they are. They're more efficient.
Time too, right? Like
lamb
drops. How long before I'm going to string it up on a gambrel and with just this? I can butcher it like a deer, and I got a pocket knife for those on the audio, right? Like, that's all I really need. I don't need, you know, a front-end loader to pull a cow up and, you know, giant bone saws and all that stuff.
Yep.
But a cow's going to take me minimum, especially grass-finished, 18 months. More like 24 for optimal yield. People always say 18 months, but those are the people that are thinking in their head, last 8 weeks at a CAFO. uh-huh. right? You know, if you're going to actually finish that thing on grass, you're looking at 2 years before you really get the yield that makes it worth taking that live.
Right.
And how long does a lamb take?
Yeah. I mean, they can be harvested when they're suckling, but, you know, full size at really good weight, 3 to 4, maybe 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Top 6 months. And then.
Yeah. And you're borderline heading into calling it mutton at 7.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, and I was saying is anybody can butcher a deer, can butcher a lamb or a goat.
Right. And also, you know, if we're talking about any kind of stink hit the fan scenario, I would much rather have my meat stored on the hoof than having to process and store 500 pounds of beef.
Mm-hmm.
To have a 2,000 pound steer that I have to get processed in the heat, possibly
all in one go.
And I don't, you know, growing up on our family farm, we would process a whole cow, and it was a family affair. By family affair, I mean all three families were pitching in. All the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was more than a dozen of us cousins, and we were all working. And it would take everybody all day to process one steer. The whole, you know, three families, a dozen cousins. That was a lot of work. But processing an animal that's the size of a really big deer or the size of a standard doe and boom, we can take one of those primal quarters and the family gets to eat on that for a few days to a week.
Yeah.
One of those primal quarters. And all we have to do is just process the rest of it.
Yeah.
That's a whole lot more doable and whole lot more practical, whole lot easier. And so when you couple that with the fact that I get more pounds of that meat off of an acre than I would with the cows, and on top of that, all right, let's just kind of game this out a little bit. Let's say I have enough property to raise 2 head of beef every year. I have enough carrying capacity on my pasture to keep 2 cows alive, one that's growing up, one that's like a stalker calf that I purchase every year, and then the other one that's approaching 2 years old. And then every year I harvest one of those. And every spring I get a new one. And so I always have just about 2 animals. What happens if one of those gets sick and dies?
You lost half of your yield, and you also, if it happens to be the older one, you lost everything that year. Or you're eating veal and getting a hell of a lot less.
Uh-huh.
And then you have nothing.
And then I have nothing for the next year.
You have nothing.
And the next year. So, So that's tough. So, I mean, if I've got a dozen sheep out there and I lose one sheep, that's not a big deal. And here's the cool thing, especially with Dorpers. Do you know what the average amount of breeding you can do with those over the course of 2 years?
I think you could probably get 3 cycles, and you probably are going to get 50% or more 20.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when we're looking at the amount of pounds of meat I get off of one ewe over the course of 2 years, we're looking at 4 to 5 lambs and probably about anywhere from 25 to 40 pounds of clean meat off of each of those lambs. That's pretty good off of one ewe.
Yeah. My thoughts on that are, once you had a system set up, if you design it from the beginning, your trees are going to be where you put them. Mm-hmm. Your laneways are going to be where you put them. Mm-hmm. Moving electro lines so that you keep the animals in is going to become really straightforward. If you're living in a community, which is what we're talking about today, if you have half a dozen guys or gals, doesn't matter, anybody can do this, half a dozen adults or older children that have enough sense to go look, do the daily task, and if something's out of whack, come tell somebody else, hey, help me fix this. maintaining sheep or goats in that situation isn't going to be that hard anymore.
Right.
It's that learning curve and getting your system in place. But yep. once that system's in place, you probably should be checking on your animals once a day anyway.
Right.
Especially if your goal is to live in nature and produce your own food. What else are you going to do?
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about this is a job for, you know, 10-year-olds can do this job.
Yeah.
My youngest can do this easy.
Yeah. Move the wire, and when right. you do, and you open the one up that's keeping them out, once they do this a couple of times, they're like, oh, all the good stuff, they go. Like, you don't have to yep. make them go. You're not driving no. them like you see on TV with the cowboy on the horse. When you open the gate and the new food is there, they go straight to it.
They're standing there ready and waiting to go, and if you have livestock guardian dogs,
yeah.
those livestock guardian dogs are going to know those kids. And they are going to love those kids.
Absolutely.
So what happens is my kids will go out there, and if I have any livestock that's at all kind of iffy about the kids and kind of squares up to them, guess what happens? Those livestock guardian dogs get in between the kids and that stock.
Yeah.
So if they're waiting to open up a paddock, the livestock guardian dogs are not running out into the paddock. They've already been there. They know what's out there.
Yeah.
Where are they going? They're going right to the feet of that kid. And if that kid yep. is just opening up a gate and the animals, all the goats and sheep or whatever, they want to get out there and get to the grass. They're not interested in the people. They just want to get out there to the grass. So as long as that kid just stands clear of the gate, so if animals bump into it, they're not going to get bowled over, right? It's as simple as lift a chain off, open the gate, the animals run. The dogs come out, they get their pets, the gate yep. gets shut,
yep.
and the kids are on the other side of the gate now, and the shift is done.
Yep.
It takes like 30 seconds.
Yep.
It's super simple, super easy, and it all comes down to if you have good design and if you have a good plan laid out from the get-go.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned that like people that have done sheep and go to goats come back to the goats, but like... Mm-hmm. The guy that does this better than anybody else I know, though he's not really doing silvopasture, because I probably wouldn't plant thousands of trees either if I didn't own the land, is yep. Greg Judy. And
100%.
Greg went from cattle and sheep to just sheep. And when I asked him why, he said, because I'm getting older and I don't want to deal with those big sumbitches anymore.
That's right.
And the other thing is like, and I'm sure you're in the same park with me on this, he does all hair sheep, St. Croix
right.
and things like that, Dorpers, what have you, because... He was the person that, like, I always felt messing with the wool wasn't worth it. But when I heard him put it this way, it costs you more money to pull the wool off the sheep than you get for the wool. Why the hell would you do that? I went, okay, we're done. We're done.
Hey,
it's not 1600s anymore. The market's not there for it.
Right. And I think it's a shame because the wool is so freaking fantastic.
Oh, it's great, but it's not economically viable.
But
I guess if you're in a community and you can have mm-hmm. a shearing day and you're using the wool internally and you're like that village down by Waco or something, sure. But if you want meat,
mm-hmm.
And then like other things go away, like fly strike.
Right.
If you've ever seen fly strike once, you never want to see it again. Ben Falk had a sheep that got it when I was up there. And so the only thing we can do is, now it's too late in the year to shear, but you've got to shear it. And we were pouring this herbal stuff on it that his now wife, girlfriend at the time, made. And it worked. But every time we dumped it on, it was like hundreds of maggots coming out of this animal's
disgusting.
Skin. It is gross. And that just, with St. Croix, Dorper, et cetera, just goes away.
Yep.
Katahdins, there just doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about cutting down as many of those learning curve things as we possibly can while
yeah.
still achieving the goals. And this comes right back to that whole thing. Well, we're going to have, you know, wool sheep because we're going to be able to make all of our own fiber and our own clothes and blah, blah, blah. And you've never done any spinning. You've never done any carding. None of that stuff. But how about instead of reaching for the moon straight from the get-go, start with hair sheep.
Yep.
That's enough of a hurdle. and then if you get the hair sheep mastered, then start adding some wool sheep in.
Yeah.
Just Try half a dozen of them.
Buy yourself a pair of wool pants and a wool shirt and go wear it when it's 95 degrees out and see if you really want to do this.
Yeah.
that might end it right. Because when I watch all like the reenactment things where they go back to like 1600s and they do all the peasant stuff and all, like the number one thing those people complain about isn't the food or the temperature inside that little peasant house. Yep. It's the clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Like they used it because it's what they had.
Right.
And it does some things really good, but. Bro, if you live in Texas or like you do Louisiana, you're down to 60 days a year that you might even think about wearing that stuff, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Let's move on to poultry, because this is a place that a lot of people really – it's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. A lot of people on smaller blocks of land that really can't handle ruminants or maybe only a small amount, they can supplement a lot with that. And it also fits well into like leader-follower systems. So what are your thoughts on birds?
Yeah, so I think birds are one of the best places to start because they're ubiquitous. They're relatively cheap. There's a lot of it going on. You know, just about everybody out in the countryside has a little land flock. So, you know, getting started with something like that is a great place to be because, you know, like I said, it's the information is readily available. And just about anyone that you ever talk to in your community is going to have experience with it and can help you out. So when it comes to the birds, though, I tend to be a little bit nonconformist with my recommendations.
Okay.
Most people say, get some chickens. Well, maybe. When it comes to, again, the easiest thing I can do and still get a yield, I much prefer Muscovy ducks.
Same.
They're so much easier. They're simpler. They're quiet. I mean, if you're in the middle of the city, you're in suburbia, right? You got a backyard. You can keep Muscovy ducks in your backyard.
Agreed.
And not get people calling, you know, whatever authority in your area because they're quiet.
They sound like,
yeah,
that's it. That's all they do. It's like a dog panting.
And if you really surprise them, there's sometimes they'll give a little honk.
Chirp. Yeah. Like a little chirp or something. But yep. It sounds like a Tweety bird in your tree, like a chickadee or something. It doesn't sound like a bird, a duck.
Yep. So the hens will sometimes do that little chirp. It's a little trilling chirp, but it's nobody would ever think that was an animal. So they're amazing mothers. They'll go broody and they will raise their babies and they'll just do it without any input from you. You don't even have to talk to them about it. They just do it.
They just do it.
Right. So, and the meat is like freaking veal, man. Oh my gosh.
Baby beef, bro. It's so good.
They're ugly as sin. They've got those, you know, the red caruncles. Looks like they've got a bad case of, you know, skin cancer all over their face.
Or something.
Right. Yeah. Gonosifa herpalade face. but.
Herpalades. Syphilitic herpalades.
Right. Right. So, you know, this is a story I tell all my clients. There was a Thanksgiving, and I had one too many drakes. And I said, all right, one of you's got to go, and eeny, meeny, miny, moe, you're the one that's got to go, right? Man, I just skinned them. I wasn't going to pluck it. It's a lot of work. And I said, you know what, for the extra fat, I'm just going to get a couple pounds of bacon and I'll give you a nice bacon blanket, breast down, bacon blanket over the back, stuffed it just like the turkeys, seasoned it just like the turkeys. And we've got this big smoker. I can put four turkeys in it. No problem. And so I had room. So I shoved this duck in there and it was almost as big as like a 25 pound turkey.
Okay.
And you know, because I'm cooking, I'm one of the last people to sit down with a plate. I load up on the duck. I pull off a whole leg quarter. I wrap it in foil and I hide it. in the toaster oven. All right. Everybody going through had seen what these ducks look like, and they're like, yeah. Ugh, I don't want to eat that.
Yeah.
So everyone gets a polite one little bite of this duck, yeah. except for one of my brothers. He loaded up too. And I load up on the duck. I get a little bit of turkey because it's turkey day, right? I'm one of the last people to go get seconds.
It's gone.
Dude. They got out a slotted spoon and were like straining any little bits of meat that they could get out of the pan.
Absolutely.
Everyone went nuts over it and said, that's one of the best things I've ever tasted. So
go ahead.
So think about Muscovies. I think geese, when we're talking about being very long-term sustainable, if you can get a large flock of geese and get them breeding and actually hatching their own eggs.
Which is challenging.
Which is challenging, but it's doable. If you can do that, the more that we can shift our animals to herbivores, the easier it is to be completely self-sufficient and self-sustaining on our own property. So I think geese have a really, really nice long-term play. Goose is fantastic. I love the meat. Muscovy is very similar to it.
Muscovies, I call them duck gooses.
Yeah.
Because they're like half goose. They really are.
Pretty much.
They taste more like a goose than a duck. They act more like a goose than a duck.
Yep.
What you're hitting on there is they graze.
Yes.
And I watch my geese, and they're just like little cows. They take a couple steps. They eat some grass, take a couple steps, eat some grass. About every fifth step, they squirt out the back, and they just keep going. And Muscovies always did that for me. One of the things I've learned about Muscovies, though, is if you want them to breed for you, you really should consider developing a system where you have containment areas where they're protected. Because what happened with mine, I had a dozen of them here 2 years ago, and I have none now. Mm. And I ended up eating the drakes and lost all my girls. And the way I lost my girls is they did not want to brood in the duck house. They wanted to find places to brood, which is good. Until they become literal sitting ducks.
They're sitting ducks.
For predators. And now it's not just the coyote you got to worry about. Now it's the fox. It's the raccoon. Like, even the raccoon, that, like, if it was squaring off, might think, I'll go get something else. When that bird's just sitting there,
yep.
with no drakes around her, because the drakes all went off to do something else at night, a raccoon just go in there and take them out.
Yep.
And so if I were to do Muscovy again here, and I would probably, like, at a certain point in the year where they're volcanoing eggs out, like throw them in my aviary or something until they hatch, yeah. and then they can come out of there.
Yeah. I'm doing the exact same thing. Cause I've had the exact same problem with mine. You know, I live on a big lake and
yeah.
so I've been letting mine free range and it's great. I love seeing them fly past.
Yeah.
That's so freaking fun to just see them flying through the woods and yep. land on the water. But when they're free roaming like that, they will lay a nest and they'll just sit there. And dude, I can't tell you how
many. They
won't
give up. I don't care what comes after them. A mother Muscovy on her nest will not give it up.
I had this one hen start setting. She is right next to the driveway, right close to the house. She's setting, and the day before, she was slated to start hatching those ducklings. Something drug her off.
Yeah.
Literally the day before.
Yeah.
Pissed me off. And I didn't find out about it until a couple of days later. So I was like, man, she should
have babies
around.
Out here by now. Yeah.
No, I go out there and it's just feathers. So
I agree with you, though, that they are one of the best options
yeah.
if you manage them properly.
Right.
And I've learned, and Nick's learned, protect them while they're nesting the hard way. Because
yep.
I've also had years where all of a sudden by the end of the year, I got like 80 of them mm-hmm. because none of the predators did get them when they were out there. So when mm-hmm. that works for you, you're like, oh, I ain't got to worry. And it's nice to not have to do anything until, well, like we talked about nature being macho man, like, elbows you in the head, and you went from having a flock of 12 to having zero. And right. it does happen. Before we move on from them, though, I also want to talk about why they are so ideal from a standpoint of husbandry. And it's because they're not really domesticated, in my opinion. Like, we've done some things with selective breeding to make them different colors, but that's it. If you told somebody, go find me an exact version of a Katahdin sheep in the wild, you're not going to find one. You're going to find a big-ass ancestor that's more than capable of taking care of itself and will horn the hell out of something that messes with it. You're not going to find a Katahdin sheep, right? You're going to climb mountains to find a sheep that that guy came from. Same thing with just about all the goats, all of that stuff, right? Cattle, you're going to find some ancient ox-like thing that will kill you dead like a Cape buffalo or something, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to find something that looks like Bessie the cow living in nature. You go down to southern Mexico and Central America and go off in the swamps, and you will find muscovies doing their thing in the wild that look exactly like kind of the mixed color, mainly black, gray, white muscovies that people have in their backyard. You won't find snow white ones, but the rest of that stuff, you'll find them. So we haven't really changed what they are. And that's why they're like the go-to duck for like city parks and stuff, because you just throw them in there and let people feed them bread and they start making more babies, and their population control in those places are turtles. And that's probably something we should mention too, because I was ready to skip right over that. If you have ponds with a bunch of the pond turtles in it, when Mama Muscovy takes those babies in there, you'll start hearing plunk, plunk, plunk. And that takes $5 for ammo and a kid with a .22 a couple times a year to keep that down. That's all that takes.
Mm-hmm.
But they will. They'll eat them all. I mean, I saw one park I was at, and I was telling this guy, get your kid, little kid, you know, like 4 years old, Mommy, where's the, like, get the kid out of here. There had to be 24. And in 5 minutes, there was none.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them was gone, because you know how those parks get. So just be aware of that, guys. What about chickens before we leave birds?
Yeah. Oh, I think chickens are fantastic. They're probably one of the best for normal eggs. So if you like eating normal eggs, everybody's idea of eggs, then chickens are fantastic. They are great in orchards. I love having a chicken system, a chicken pen, a chicken run, the chicken coop and yard right next to, preferably in between, a garden and an orchard, because then I can selectively allow them out into the garden for cleanup or into the orchard. And so adding chickens in there, because they're such good predators, and the Muscovies, chickens and the Muscovies housed together, fantastic. Right. They do great, especially as a mixed flock for your integrated pest management in your orchard is fantastic, because you can limit them when you need to limit them so that you don't have fruit damage. But when you have some fruit being shed, because that happens, then those birds will go in there and they'll clean that stuff up and help reduce or, I mean, sometimes even eliminate any perceptible insect damage. So having those chickens, they can do a tremendous amount of work for you. They're great at processing food waste and creating compost. Bill just said they destroy everything if free range. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that, you know, I've never had nearly as much problem with Muscovies destroying everything on free range.
They're lazy.
They're
freaking lazy. They don't want to do anything. They don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they just won't bother my plants. Yeah. They're fantastic with insects. If you've got grasshopper problems, those Muscovies will actually fan out and harvest those grasshoppers.
Mm-hmm.
Just snatch them right out of the air. But the chickens can be pretty destructive. They're like little dinosaurs running around looking for everything they can eat, and they will eat your tomatoes, and they'll eat your peppers, and they will scratch all of your mulch away from everything that you want mulch on and put the mulch in places you don't want it. They're powerful as a system.
Tool, right? If you channel the energy, they're a great disturbance tool. Disturbance isn't always bad, but you want it where you want it, when you want it, for the purpose you want it. And the chicken doesn't give a chicken has a pea brain. You couldn't teach that chicken. Now, what I have learned, like, you know, I had my experience with bantams and I decided to get rid of them because they were flying everywhere and roosting everywhere and pooping on everything. And this year I brought in Jersey Giants, and because they're fat and lazy and they don't really want to get up in a 2 foot high raised bed, which is how I do all my gardening, but they will get up there. But what I determined is chicken terrorism works. So what I had is the kids once an hour going out to see if they were up in the garden. And if they were, they took a big piece of PVC pipe and beat the shit out of the metal trellis and started screaming. Well, now they're afraid of it. They're like, that's a bad place. And I did it a lot myself because I raised these guys by hand. So I'm like the head chicken to them. And they're like, well, he says it's bad. It must be really bad. But like, that doesn't mean they don't cause any problems at all.
Right.
They really need more control. And then the other thing is I got 3 acres and 7 birds. They're going to cause a lot less trouble. And if you're trying to grow enough of them to feed a family, you ain't going to do it with 7. You eggs, sure. But if you want meat and reproduction and all, you need – so I think stocking density plays a role in that too.
Yeah, stocking density, and also just make sure you have the infrastructure before you get them. Because if you don't have the infrastructure and you're just expecting, I'm just going to let them run around and be chickens and they're we're just going to live in this utopia of chicken and people gardening paradise. Well, I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen. So
but you if know you what have happens, the, right? Tom and Karen go to Tractor Supply and they see the cute little peeps and they have no infrastructure and they think, well, we have time. So Tractor Supply has them in a stock tank. They have a stock tank at home. So they come home and put a little feeder and a little light and a little water and some wood chips. And they stick them in there and they go, well, we'll get this done. 3 weeks later, those chickens are flying the hell out of there all over your house, pooping on your table, your kitchen table. And you still have no infrastructure. Right. Because they grow really fast. They're not cows. They grow fast, man. You know?
Yeah. But again, I think they're fantastic. You just need to have the infrastructure and you need to have something for them to do. So utilizing the chickenness of the chickens is critical, and knowing they want to scratch and they want to peck stuff. So give them stuff to do and give them stuff to do that is going to be productive and purposeful for your system.
Yeah. The other thing I like about them, and if you can figure out how to hatch birds that are worth doing it with, is you can have a small flock as your kind of your mother flock and your egg flock. And then you can say, I want to produce 25 chickens a year. Well, you take 25 chicken eggs and throw them in an incubator. You're probably going to get 24 to hatch. So throw 30 in there and you're going to make your bogey and have room for some mortality. And you put those birds in a tractored situation where that larger group of birds isn't messing stuff up and you are channeling the disruption in the behavior to something productive. But you know, if it's like, if you buy them in their Cornish crosses, it's 8 to 10 weeks of that. If you're doing something like Jersey Giants or Bress or something, it's 16, 18 weeks. But the beauty in that is at the end of that cycle, you process all your birds. It's a busy Saturday. You put them in the freezer. Done. I am done until my next, and I can do 2 runs a year like that, spaced out 6 months. And there is a beauty in being done with something that's a productive.
Very much so.
And having downtime to like do all the other stuff that you actually need to do. Cause I know, you know, there's a lot of it and I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do that. No, you're not. Cause when are you going to have time?
That's right. Yeah. So if we're talking about meat birds, having a run or two, that's just like, boom, we've got birds in the freezer and we're done. That's really nice. Again, that's making sure you have the infrastructure and you're putting the birds to a productive use.
And just before we move on to small stock, I'll just say real quick, in between muscovies and chickens is probably regular ducks. They're not quite as easy and they're not quite as motherly as muscovies, but they're just about as easy and they actually work harder. Like muscovies, somebody just said they're freeloaders if you let them. Like you talked about the muscovies rounding up insects. My duck flock, once the grasshoppers come like right now, they just murder grasshoppers all day long. And I've also found with ducks, the older they get, the more broody they become. So right now I have 7 ducklings running around with mother, and the goose never took care of her eggs this year. So she's adopted them. So she's got like co-parent going on now, but we have 5 clutches of broody moms, and I'm just hoping they don't get taken out by predators, because now they're doing what the Muscovies did a couple of years ago. They're spread out, but they're smarter. They're like all up by the front gate where the cars and shit are, and where the dogs spend more time and stuff like that, where the Muscovies all wanted to be out by the back fence by Dennis's place. And like, they pick the worst, most vulnerable places to go. But ducks are a great option too, I think. And you might have an easier time sourcing them unless you're going to like take a bag of bread to the park, because the government doesn't want you to notice, but those ducks are free.
I was going to bring that up.
You've seen a cast net. They don't want you to know.
Uh-huh.
But it ends with, and I have 451 ducks.
Uh-huh. Yep, a cast net at dusk might get you a couple.
Wonder Bread and a cast net, yeah. You know? Honestly, a lot of times they're so tame, you can just throw some bread down, and I'll do it every once in a while, even if I don't take them home, just grab one. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to small stock next, but I got to say something about Muscovies. Muscovies are not like your normal waterfowl when it comes to danger. They do have a danger, and that is their claws on their feet are designed so they can roost in trees and not fall out, right? When they squat and they get that natural clench that comes, those claws dig into that wood. They will cut you hardcore. And there was a day I was texting Nick, and I was also texting Nicole Saws. And Nicole sent me a picture of some really she was this close to going to the ER for stitches and having a vein bleed, right? But she sends me this picture, and I thought Nick sent it to me. And so I responded with ha 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 ha, smiley face. And I hit send, and like 30 seconds later, I look at it and go, oh, shit, that was Nicole. Because I'm like, who knows better? But I just want people to know, like, the way they can cut you is not like a chicken or a goose or a regular duck. It is razor blade level, except that it hurts more because it's not actually sharp. It's just really pointed.
Yeah.
So they don't just cut you. They'll hurt you. And so when I have to handle them, I'll put on like a jacket.
Yep,
like a leather jacket or something like that, so I know that I'm protected, or minimum wear like long, like welding gloves or something, because they will jack you up.
Mm-hmm.
I felt obligated because I know I'm going to get the picture, right?
Really good. That's a really good point. Like you know, warning people.
Where they get you.
Yep, right, warning there. People. Just like buying one of Patrick's knives, just give them a heads up. Be careful.
Yep. Okay, so let's talk about small stock. Now, this really isn't a silvopasture thing directly.
Right.
But it certainly can be indirectly tied into silvopasture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of people that I figured in the audience would be thinking, you know, I'm going to have the silvopasture thing, but I don't have enough land to actually, you know, hit my targets. So what could I do that could dovetail into the silvopasture system, where I could use some of that excess from the silvopasture system to also, you know, bump up my meat production? Well, small stock like rabbits and quail, I think, would fit very nicely into this, especially once you start getting into more complicated, multifaceted systems, raising insects like black soldier fly larvae. There's a tremendous amount that you can do with the rabbit manure, and things like white mulberry leaves to feed black soldier fly larvae to feed your insectivores. That was one of the main reasons why I had quail years ago. They're fantastically productive.
Yeah.
Fantastically productive. But the feed costs are astronomical.
Relative you've got to buy the tiny little ass egg you get,
right,
and the little tiny breast, you know, that I go to the dove field and fill my freezer with doves. Why am I going to pay to feed a quail?
Right.
I never thought about that, using vegetation to feed the protein source, source for the quail.
Mm-hmm.
Because soldier fly larvae will eat white mulberry.
Yes.
They don't want nothing to do with lignin. You give them straw or dried leaf or whatever. Mm-hmm. They don't want that. But something like a nice, tender, delicious mulberry. Which
30% protein?
Producing a shitload at the same time, because the soldier flies aren't going to be hanging out in December. They're done gone for the year, right? So while that tree is producing
that
rich fodder, that soldier fly is also willing to do its business.
That's right. And so if you couple that with rabbits and you've got a run of meat chickens during the summer, well, what happens when you process all those meat chickens? You've got a whole bunch of guts. You can just bury those in the garden. Sure. But why not just process all those feathers and chicken heads and chicken guts and everything that you're not going to eat? Process that through the black soldier fly larva. And then turn that into some larva that you either dry in a solar dehydrator outside or you throw them in freezer bags in your freezer. And now you have some fantastic live, well, not live food anymore, but some fantastic real food that's not GMO. Right. For your quail, for your chickens, for your Muscovies during the winter months. So we can take advantage of that summer flush that you're going to have from your silvopasture system, especially if you're growing stuff that are really good, high protein fodder leaves for your herbivores, because you might just have too much of it during the summertime and you don't want to, and you don't want to process it all. You got a little too much. You can feed some fresh to your rabbits. You can feed the excess to your black soldier fly larva, because it's dead simple. You open up the bin and you throw it in and you close the lid and it's going to wilt down and they're going to eat it.
And I'll add, if you're doing any kind of aquatic systems, like you got ponds at the end, so we won't go deep into this yet, but I have found black soldier flies love Lazola. They eat the crap out of Lazola. So you could take like half a stock tank of Lazola off, feed your black soldier flies for a few days, add in some white mulberry for diversity, and go back 4 or 5 days later, and that stock tank is covered over again with Azolla. It doesn't double as fast as duckweed under optimal conditions, like every 48 hours. But I've seen my Azolla tend to double about once every 5 days, which means once you're full every 5 days, you can take half as a harvest all through the summer, especially if you get some shade. Like Azolla and direct sun do not mix. They're a fern, right? Where do ferns grow? They grow in pine barrens and stuff like that. They like a little bit of shade. But yeah, I really never, because that was my one, and I got rid of quail for two reasons. One, what you just said, I got to feed them, and I really wasn't being able to get much of a yield for them to supplement the feed. I don't even care if I had to feed them 25% of what I normally have to feed them. I don't want to feed them 100% from the feed store.
That's right.
The other reason was my wife wouldn't eat them, so I was doing it just for me. But the first one was a bigger issue. Like, the cost of production was too high.
Right.
You know? That's genius, Nick. You got guinea pigs on here, though, really?
Several years ago, I was down in Ecuador, and I tried cooey, and it's not bad. So if you're trying to get independent on smaller acreage and you know, you're thinking about this whole silvopasture thing and you're like, man, well, I have an acre or I have 2 acres or I have a quarter of an acre. And well, what do I do? Well, dude, you can tractor things like rabbits and guinea pigs underneath of those fodder trees. And you can still have a silvopasture with just small herbivores. So, you know, we don't have to get stuck in this idea of silvopasture is only cows or sheep or goats underneath these great big trees. Mm-hmm. It can be scaled down a whole lot to the point where
half acre suburban backyard with some rows of trees and you're running little tractors of rabbits or cooey under there.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And so, I mean, I try to always encourage people, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Do something. Even if it's not the best, even if it's not amazing, doing anything that will move that needle from total dependency on the systems to somewhat independent, anything is, even if it's the majority of the benefit is just mental and lowering your cortisol levels, because I've got a little bit of control back in my life. I think it can be really, really beneficial. So don't discount things like growing, you know, in a suburban setting. I've got some mulberry bushes in in, you know, big planter pots in a tiny quarter acre lot, an eighth of an acre lot. And I've, you know, it's just in big planter pots, 20 gallon pots.
Yeah.
And I've got a little hutch with some rabbits, and I've got a little cage with some guinea pigs that I'm moving around, and I've got a black soldier fly bin in the corner, and I've got some quail. You can still have a silvopasture system that's just in miniature. Think of it like a bonsai tree.
And I've seen some really interesting communities developed in suburbs, especially like decaying suburbs, where people go in and buy the whole block.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that costs less than buying 100 acres and building 18 houses.
Mm-hmm.
It costs a lot less, right? And your individual community members, now we're not trying to put some agreement together. They go to the bank, get a mortgage, buy the house.
Right.
Right. And I've seen even people like, one I saw, it was about 18 houses, but four of them in the center, they didn't have any mm-hmm. dog conflicts or anything like that. So they took all the separating fences. So they yep. had one big open area. And then the dude that couldn't do that because he didn't want the dog conflict, he put in a bunch of mulberries, not really uh-huh. for the reason we're talking about, but for the drop. He put yep. them right up against the fence. So all those mulberries that dropped on that side fed the birds that they had. So, like,
right.
there are other options. You can build a community in That's a right. more urban environment. Now, you might have more Karen problems.
Sure.
Right. Department of Making You Sad problems. But there's also a lot of some of these neighborhoods that are more rural to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of Department of Making You Sad action because there ain't no money for it.
That's right.
Right. So I think there is opportunity there. And I think people should explore that.
Yeah.
Before we move on from the small stock, on the screen right now, Victory Garden said, I've seen bad guinea pig feed conversion versus rabbits, but they're cool. But you know when feed conversion stops mattering? When you're not paying for it. Right? If they're living on grass and clover and mulberry leaf and willow leaf,
yep.
does it matter that their conversion ratio is not as high as a rabbit's when you're mm-hmm. talking about feeding one or two families? I don't think it really matters anymore.
Yeah. And it's, you know, let's say you've got a small community. You're in suburbia. And there's four families, and all of your lots are bumping up against each other. You got four families together, and you're raising pets. You don't have livestock in the city limits. No.
We have some
pets, and each there's family
pigs and some quail and uh-huh. right. Yeah,
each rabbit. Family is allowed a certain number of chickens. Each family is allowed a certain number of whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then you have a whole bunch of meat-producing animals that you're raising for free because you have some trees grown in the backyard.
Yep.
Well, I mean, this is total gray man approach. So we don't have to get stuck in this. We're going to buy, you know, 1,000 acres, and we're going to have 50 families all together, and we're going to raise, you know, this big old herd of cattle and feed everybody beef. This can be scaled right down to backyard size communities in suburbia.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also allows for more load sharing that way, because right. like if you're a rabbit dude, you know all about rabbits. You've been doing rabbits your whole life. If we did the suburban settlement and you were part of my community, I'd be like, well, you be the rabbit dude.
Right.
Right. And then maybe I raise quail because I have a lot of experience with quail and I actually really like quail. And if I can take your rabbit turds and feed them to black soldier flies to feed my quail, all of a sudden that because the way you make this community, and the only reason you'd want to do this community thing
synergy.
Is you don't want to do everything.
Synergy.
Right? Like, I'm the quail dude, and we get per run, let's say we do, you know, we do culls plus intentionally grown six-week chicks, and I could easily produce out of a yard like that every run 100 quail. Like, mm-hmm. And I don't need a lot. I need maybe 6 girls and 2 males mm-hmm. as my breeders to do that. And so we got 4 families of 25 quail apiece. That's, you know, I'll be honest, I will sit down and eat 4 whole quail, no problem. That's
right.
still a significant yield, especially if we're not paying for feed, or now my feed bill just went to 25%.
Right.
Right. You know, and I think there's a lot of potential. And I actually think a lot of people listening to this that have that mental fantasy someday of moving way out in them, I think it's actually a lot more doable to think in that small block mindset. Right. And I would even say a lot of them would do better off if they did score the 25-acre piece of land, build what looks like a neighborhood first, because everybody being out on their own, that's not why you're doing a community. Use some communal space and develop this, like, think of it as permaculture. Develop your zone one and two before you're four.
Right.
Right. Or while your four's growing, because you don't want to put all those animals out there in the baking sun because you bought an open field and there are no trees yet. And you're just getting that infrastructure established. This you can establish in a matter of weeks to months, where a larger silvopasture system, we're looking at years to get it fully established.
That's right. Yeah, it takes time to get that stuff established. And I think that's where some of these smaller livestock come into play and really shine, because they breed very fast and they don't need the great big systems to be productive. So, you know, if you're starting out with these smaller livestock and allowing that to get you some production and some kind of wiggle room and buffer while you're getting the larger systems established and grown in and really productive, there's a lot of great utility for that.
All right, let's talk about feeding all this stuff. And again, I want to reiterate what we just covered. All these trees that Nick's about to talk to you about can be on a fence line in the suburbs on a quarter acre lot.
Correct.
They don't have – now, they work great in a large system too. Just, you know, if you can grow a tree in a place, you can grow a tree that's productive for some reason instead of completely non-productive, like, you know, something like a live oak, and at least that makes an acorn. But there's a ton of trees people are lollipop planting in the front yard that don't do – like Bartlett – not Bartlett. What's the – Bartlett's
actually – Bradford.
Bradford pear. If there is a more useless tree that, by the way, at about 15 years old, it just falls apart – I don't know. I don't know anything more useless. So let's talk about some of the trees that we can grow as fodder.
Yeah. So the king of fodder trees, in my opinion, is always going to be white mulberry. It's my go-to. If I had to plant only one species, it would be Morris alba. Now, I don't advocate for just doing that. I think a varied diet is a good idea for just about everything. If you look at a good pasture, a good pasture is going to have a smorgasbord of greens and species for those herbivores to eat, and I think that's a very good thing. So when we're talking about these trees, and I say this is my top pick, and I always talk about white mulberry, if you're doing only one thing, get some white mulberry.
Okay.
But don't think that this is the be-all, end-all. Always be striving for as much diversity as we possibly can. So my number one pick for the fodder trees is the white mulberry, followed by the hybrid willow, just because it's so dead simple to propagate. Probably third on that list, not for its value as a fodder tree, but for its utility and ease of growing, would be the hybrid poplar. Not everything likes to eat the hybrid poplar. It grows very fast. It's a fantastic fuel wood source. It makes amazing biochar. Lots of animals do like to eat it. But one of the best things about it is it's you take a stick and jab it in the ground and it makes another tree. So when we're talking about shoestring budgeting, getting a system up and going, if you start with nothing else but hybrid poplar and hybrid willow, you get one of those to grow. You can turn it into a dozen trees the next year, and then 250 trees the next year. So those are kind of my top three. I'd have right up there with lacebark elm. And that's a tree that is so ubiquitous as a landscape tree that most of the USA, they're beautiful trees and they're really good fodder trees. So those are kind of my top four. And then when we're talking about kind of the mast drop trees for that silvopasture overstory. So whether this is a big macro scale or, you know, a yard scale, I would say chestnut, pecan, white oak, persimmon, pear, mulberry, and crab apple. So you just already talked about white mulberry, Nick. Well, if you're growing mulberry for the fruit drop, because you have something that likes to eat mulberries, like pigs and chickens and stuff, then something like a Hicks Everbearing mulberry or Silk Hope is another really good one. Dr. A.J. Bullard selected that mulberry. It's my horticultural mentor's favorite mulberry, and he has dozens. For years, he said that the Hicks Everbearing was his holy grail. I actually have a video. I set my camcorder up in the back of my truck, and I had it going. I was mic'd up. And he had told me for years, you know, I asked him, "Peavine, if there was one tree that I could show up with and blow your socks off, what would it be?" And he told me Hicks Everbearing mulberry, and he told me the story of it. And years later, a friend of mine was able to, with Dr. A.J. Bullard's help, identify it and save it from destruction. And so they found a Hicks Everbearing. It was believed to be extinct. Okay. And they got it. We got them. And I'm working on getting them propagated, but, that would be one of the top ones. And I was able to show up to his property and say, and showed him a mulberry, and he looked at it kind of with this grin. And I said, "You know what this is?" He said, "Well, that's a mulberry." And I said, "You know what kind it is?" And he said, "No." And I said, "No what?" He said, "Nuh-uh." Where did you? I said, "Dr. A.J. Bullard found it." He said, "It's not." And I said, "It's not what?" He didn't even want to say Hicks. I said, "Dr. A.J. found a Hicks."
And for him, it was like you showing up at my house with a 67 Fastback Mustang and handing me the keys.
Right.
You know, like.
So, man, he lit up like the Vegas Strip. It was one of my proudest days of my life, being able to give my horticultural mentor his holy grail tree. You know, that would be in there. Crab apples, pears. You know, there's a large swath of the USA that is battling Bradford pears. You know, you said there's just about nothing else that's more worthless than a Bradford. I'll send you a picture. I don't know if you want to put it up on the show notes. My in-laws had a Bradford in their front yard, and they said they were going to be cutting it down this, I think March. It was a little bit late to be grafting in Louisiana, but, they said, "We're cutting this tree down." I said, "Well, why don't you just top work it?" "What's that?" I said, "Well, you've got that good pear in the backyard. Y'all like that pear, right?" "Well, yeah." I said, "Why don't I just graft some of that onto this one?" "You can do that?" I said, "Yeah." "Well, how do we do that?" I said, "I can do that right now." They said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." So I grabbed my silky saw. I didn't have any grafting tape, so we used electric tape. And I just knocked the top of that joker off. It was 14 feet tall and probably a good 6-inch diameter trunk, and went to the backyard, and I clipped a couple pieces of good scion wood off of it, and I grafted 5 sticks onto it, and all 5 took, except one of them got fire blight. And so my mother-in-law broke off the one with fire blight, and now it's about 3 foot tall in as many months.
Awesome.
So when we're talking about, you know, how do we do this stuff, and what can I utilize that's already on my property? I bet for most of the Midwest, you got some Bradford pears grown on your property. Learn how to graft. Pear is the easiest thing to graft. Learn how to graft. Get some scion wood. Get one or two, maybe 3 different cultivars of pears. Even if it's just local, the hard canning pears from somewhere in your region that's not covered in fire blight. And learn how to graft that stuff, and just knock the tops off of those Bradfords and just top work them. And then you'll have tons of pears dropping, and lots of stuff likes to eat pears. And, you know, I don't know if your audience knows this, but carbohydrates are what put fat on mammals.
Yeah.
So if you want fat meat, get them some carbs. And so, you know, that's pear. That's a super easy one.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned persimmon, too. And I think going back to our original topic of these larger animals, especially cattle.
Yes.
With a persimmon, and you don't need the fancy, you know, Fuyu persimmons that we like to eat that don't need to be bled. They're expensive, $30 up a tree, unless you're making your own. Good old, easy to propagate from seed, American persimmon. That's a huge tree.
Yep.
You end up with this tree that going into the late fall, early winter has all these amazing high sugar, high carbohydrate mast. And every time the wind blows, a bunch of them drop, and a cow will walk over top of your face to get a persimmon. I was hunting, it had to be 20 years ago now, on the edge of a bean field in Pennsylvania, bow hunting. And there was like a little fork horn bug, and he was just past, like he was like 45 yards out. And I'm not quite the guy that's going to take a 45 yard shot with a bow. And he was eating under a persimmon tree. And I'm like, if you come a little closer, bro, you're dead. He ate every one of them. And he started trotting across the field away from me. And I'm like, damn it. The wind blew. One persimmon hits the ground. That deer stopped, 180, ran back, ate that persimmon, and then left. I'm like, well, I know I'm going to set up tomorrow. And he ended up backstraps. But that day he got away. But it blew me away how addicted to that thing he was. And as I started to learn about grazing, cattle, et cetera, and looked at how cattle treat them, they treat them the exact same way. And so you've got this late high carbohydrate yield when everything else is down in production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Persimmon, just because of the high sugars. I mean, sugars are so fantastic for packing on that fat and that those calories late in the season. That's what you want with any kind of grazing system. You want some of those carbohydrates in the fall just to pack on fat. So I mean, that's why pretty much all of these are sugar producing trees. They drop some kind of carbs, chestnuts, whether that's Chinese chestnut or a hybrid chestnut like the Dunstan. There's multiple different hybrid chestnuts out there now. Those are fantastic. Pecans and white oaks. You know, those three big mast-dropping trees are fantastic. And they each drop mast at different times of the year. So, you know, being able to spread that stuff out. And, you know, if you're planning out, you know, we're going to the macro design here. We've got, you know, over 100 acres. And we get some of these trees wholesale, right? We buy 100 of each of them. Just a native red mulberry. A wild crab apple. We've got a whole bunch of those pears just out all over the place, and we just graft on top of them. And you order 100 persimmon, 100 white oak, 100 pecan, 100 chestnut, and we just stagger them alternating. You're going to end up with some die-off, but eventually you're going to end up with a system that will your stocking density will increase so much that, just like I talk about in my presentations on being free of the feed store, dude, your stocking density will bump up, and in times that of hardship, you're not going to be beholden to the feed store. Your profit margins will be so much higher. It's some of these are almost like, you know, setting things up for your children or your grandchildren.
Yes.
Because it takes a long time for a white oak to start producing. You know, it takes a while for
25 years in earnest. Yeah. For a white oak. Yeah. For most of them.
Yeah.
A few that are earlier, but like your big white oaks, your bur oaks, things like that, your 25-year trees.
Right. Right. So, you know, this isn't like, you know, tomorrow production with white mulberry, for instance. We can actually get really good yields the second year that it's
Absolutely.
In the ground.
Absolutely.
We're not going to get that with these nut trees. But if we're thinking about, if we're only thinking short term, we're not going to have that long term maturity and broad spectrum health and resiliency that we can get out of a system that is well designed from the get go. And, you know, you don't want to start planting these oaks 10 years after your system is getting mature. You want to get them in the ground as soon as you can, because there's a lot we can do in the short term to get some really good productivity with things like those fodder trees.
Yeah, I just had a vision when you were talking about that too, and it's taking like 25 years to production. And when I said that, what popped in my head is, and that tree is probably, if you're going to selectively harvest some timber, 100 years from being worthy of being taken down for timber, 100 years. Mm-hmm. You're like a silky oak, bur oak, something like that. So I have this vision when I said that of, you know, like, one of our grandchildren being a grown ass man in his 40s or 50s, you know, maybe his 50s, and looking at maybe 25 years, might be more, but 25 years of like being able to actually work out in the field, having a conversation with a grandchild and saying, we're planting oaks today because they're going to take 25 years to come in production to replace those oaks over there. So your kid can build a house on this property with that oak tree. Now, we have somebody in here telling us we're all destroying the planet and whatever in the live chat. I don't know if you've seen that going on. But you tell me who's talking all this bullshit about cow farts warming the planet is thinking in those timelines, because I don't know any of them that are. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to say, is not only is this doable, it's also the most sustainable way humans can live on the planet, because it's how the planet operated before we were here.
Right.
We already said this, right? The most productive ecosystem terrestrial, because I got to take marine out of that, because it's a different world. Most productive terrestrial ecosystems in the world are savannas. This is not my opinion, as I've been told in the live chat. It's not Nick's opinion. That is actual fact. That's some actual settled science, because you guys can go to an ecosystem and measure biomass production and carbon sequestration into the soil. And you can test that, and you can say, it's savanna. It's not even close. Nothing else is even close. Okay, you answer me this, Nick. With your opinion, right, how would a savanna be maintained without humans and machinery, without ruminants, and stay a savanna?
It wouldn't be.
It wouldn't. It would turn into jungle or desert.
Right.
Those are your two choices. It's jungle or desert, or forest or desert.
Yeah, for the people that have bought into the mainstream lies about the cow fart stuff, I would ask them to do a little bit of research. Just look up any leftist publication that you want to. How many bison did the evil white men kill? How many bison were there before colonization?
Best estimate is 50 million, and I think it's low.
Okay. Take whatever official number you want to.
Yeah.
And then compare that to the number of cattle being produced in the USA. And so if the cow farts are a problem, then we are operating in a massive deficit.
Correct.
In a massive deficit. I would postulate that a far, far greater production of methane is actually from the loss of soil being washed out into the Gulf, and that soil degrading in the Gulf and releasing methane than any kind of cattle operation. I do not think that mainstream CAFO cattle operations are good systems. But if we're talking about methane being the boogeyman, there is far, 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 far less methane being produced by cattle than there ever was being produced with buffalo, with bison on the plains. And if the world was a better, healthier, less greenhouse gassy place 200 years ago, with more methane being produced, then the whole methane stupid argument just completely falls apart on its face. There's just no logic to it.
Not to mention, you mentioned the CAFOs, and when they give you this methane per cow number, they're jacking around with some stuff there without full disclosure. They're including that lagoon of cow crap at those CAFOs in that methane calculation. Then they call it cow farts. I don't know if you know the difference between taking a dump and farting, but if you don't, you'll learn and you'll go change the drawers. They're mm-hmm. not the same thing. When a cow poops in a pasture, we do not get the methane yield into the atmosphere that you get when you pile up nothing but cow poop 6 foot deep in a lagoon outside of CAFO. That patty, like, so imagine this little thought experiment. You have a bunch of grass and trees and forbs, and you want to improve the quality of the soil and sequester more carbon into the soil so that all of our friends are happy. We have, if carbon goes in the soil, there's less in the atmosphere because we only get it one place. Like, we aren't making any more carbon. All the carbon that will ever be on Earth, unless we get hit by a giant asteroid of carbon, is already here. You need a star to combine lower elements into higher level elements. I don't have a star in my backyard. I don't think you have a nuclear fusion reactor in your backyard or on your pond down there, you know. Maybe you bought some uranium from the Lebanese or whatever. What was in the Back to the Future? Was it the Lebanese or whatever that he bought the uranium from? Or plutonium. So we can't make more. All we can do is change its location. That's it. So if I want a perfect machine to take all this vegetative growth and put the carbon into the soil and improve my soil biology, I'd want a machine that chopped it all up into really fine bits, made it moist, held it for about 72 hours in a fermentation, and then deposited it as a semi-liquid form that would spread out onto the ground. I'd want it to be green energy, so I'd want it to be powered by the sun and the vegetation itself. And then I would want lots of little critters to come eat it and incorporate it into the soil. Do you have a name for this machine?
I bet we could probably, with Bill Gates' help, we could probably come up with some kind of machine that slave children in China could build for us.
I'm thinking the Bovine 1000 is what we would call it, the Bovine 1000.
Oh, you mean that already exists?
Powered by solar panels, it chops the stuff up and macerates it, ferments it in about 100-degree environment for 72 hours, and then deposits it for the dung beetles and stuff. Or, here's a crazy-ass idea. We could use cows. That's what a cow is. A cow is a solar-powered vegetation processing machine that improves soil fertility. And anybody tells you otherwise, I'm going to tell you what they don't know. Anything about the carbon cycle, the water cycle, or ruminants. They can't know about those three subjects and tell you anything any differently. Sorry. And that's why I don't really tolerate any of this BS anymore, because I think we've tolerated it long enough and it's time to push back. But yeah, at least we get disrupted. Let's talk a little bit about fuel, and then you got something here about ponds and fish, and we'll wrap up. So let's talk about fuel, because like now we have all these trees. The cow doesn't want to eat the pieces big around as your wrist. So now we have this other yield, and it turns out sometimes people don't like to be cold, or they want to cook food or some other things. So how does fuel play into this type of system?
Yeah, so again, we're coming back to understanding what this ecosystem is producing. What are the yields? What are the inputs? And understanding exactly how we can utilize the waste stream to benefit both our ecosystem and our way of life. So our prosperity. So for the people that are, you know, very, very concerned about carbon in the atmosphere, while I, for one, think we need more carbon in the atmosphere, I also think we need more carbon in the soil. So how about we take some of that waste stream and we carbonize it and we lock it up for millennia? We turn it into carbon in the form of biochar, and we put it in the soil, and we lock it up for millennia.
Now you're singing out of my hymn book.
I think that is one of the best things that we can do with it. Now, second to that, that's probably second. You know, keeping ourselves alive through the winter is probably the primary concern. Important.
Yeah. So, race to death ain't good. It's just a survival podcast. If you die, you failed the test. That's the one test. Are you still here? Then you get a lot of bonus points for like quality of life. But the first test is don't die. And when you freeze to death, you fail.
Right.
So I'm with you. Like, let's keep the house warm.
So we can heat our homes and our greenhouses with fuel wood from these tree systems. Right. I think one of the longest term beneficial things that we can do with that fuel wood, short of making sure we're alive and everyone's fed every year, is as much as we can make biochar, start with our gardens, our most intensive systems, build up that carbon in there, because the more carbon we have in that soil, the more life we have, the more fertility, the more productivity, the less disease, the less insect pressure we're going to have. It's going to snowball into greater success with our gardening systems. And then you branch out into your fruit trees. You branch out into your fodder trees, and then you keep working that out and out and out until you're putting that carbon back out onto your pastures. You're feeding some of that biochar through your ruminants, and they're dropping it directly where it needs to be. And we keep stacking that and keep stacking that. I think you would have to do that for generations to restore to the carbon levels in the soils, especially in the Great Plains. I think it would take generations to return to the levels that it was pre-industrialization. So, you know, when you're cutting these fodder trees, if you're not doing it in a coppice system, which is cutting it to the ground every winter, and you're harvesting like low bushes, almost like a lawn, you're going to cut it, you know, once every couple weeks kind of thing, maybe once a week if you're in really high growth phase of that tree's life. You're treating it like a lawn. If you're growing that in a pollard system, like a silvopasture system, where the trees are above the browse height and you're reaching up there and you're lopping off branches, you're going to be taking off branches that are, you know, maybe, you know, tool handle size, maybe wrist size. Yeah. Right. You're going to drop that branch on the ground. The animals are just going to mob it. They're going to strip all the leaves off of it. And while it's still green, it's really easy to cut. You get out there and you chop it all up and you throw it in a trailer and you haul it off. And you let it dry, and you use it for either fuel, you use it to cook on, you use it to heat your home, use it to maybe heat a greenhouse. Under really extreme conditions, you might use it to heat a barn to keep your livestock healthy and comfortable, to keep your birds from getting frostbite or whatever. And then anything that we have left over that we don't hold in reserve for the next year for heating, we put through a biochar process to start that recarbonization cycle. I mean, we can do this for a long time and not do too much. So
there's a couple things in there I want to hit on. Number one, you know how to use a chainsaw. I've seen you do it. Let's say you and I were working a woodlot and we dropped a bunch of trees and we needed somebody to buck. And we needed buck, for the people that don't know, that means cutting into sizable firewood pieces. And we wanted somebody to get rid of the slash. And I said, which job do you want, Nick? Which job do you want? Do you want a buck or de-slash?
I'd rather buck.
Yeah. So you just said, like what you just pointed out there, your ruminants can do most of the de-slash for you. Mm-hmm. Now you're out to a stripped down piece of wood. And somebody here mentioned rabbits like twigs. Well, sheep and cattle will eat the small twigs too.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when that tree's green. So we've got it up above the browse line. The cow can't screw it up on us. We come out, you got it pollard about, let's say, shoulder to head height now. And you just drop.
Just lop them off.
Let the animals do what they want to do and then come back and take the. And that way you know that you fed them whatever they actually would eat.
That's right.
You know, you're not out there stripping leaves off and making tree hay or whatever, which is a strategy and maybe has a place for getting through winter. But for day-to-day operations, let the animal do the daggone work. So in Seth Holzer's word, you don't have to do it for yourself. Like, I remember somebody asked him in Montana, they said, well, what if I don't want pigs? And he said, well, you got to do the pig's job.
That's right.
right? You don't want a cow. You got to do the cow's job. What's the cow's mm-hmm. job? Mow the lawn and strip the tree. It's up to right. you if you want to do the work or let the cow do it. Mm-hmm. Then on the biochar thing, and you mentioned heating, we can combine those. I don't know if you've seen how some people are doing this now, but they're taking a wood stove mm-hmm. and taking what you call a hotel pan, which is basically a stainless steel tray with a lid, and they're filling it with small bits of wood or wood chips or whatever, putting a lid on it, and they stick it inside the wood stove while the main fire's going. It mm-hmm. heats up the wood that's inside the container. It starts to off-gas. You actually get the benefit of the off-gas because the fire consumes the gas. You get right. more thing out, and about once every hour or hour and 45 minutes, you pull that tray out, set it aside, and stick another full tray in. By the time that one's done, this one's cooled off, we can dump it somewhere, and you're producing biochar from your small scrap while you're heating your house.
Very nice.
The only reason I don't do it is I don't need a freaking wood stove in this house. I only have to heat like 6 weeks out of the year.
Right.
So it doesn't rate that for me. But if I was living in a more temperate climate, mm-hmm. I would absolutely be doing this because why wouldn't you?
Right.
You know? That's one of the coolest things I've seen. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts with ponds and fish. People that listen to me and watch my stuff know I have these little bitty garden ponds, timber frame, whatever. I only do that because I can't dig a hole. And I think even in suburbia, you have a lot of potential to use aquatics in mm-hmm. your systems here and produce fish. And I need you to carry this one for at least 3 minutes because I got to do something right here.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to the aquatic systems, you know, even the smaller systems that are, you know, just a few hundred gallons, there's a tremendous amount of potential to pull protein out of that every year. And if we are, again, we're talking about a little bit more intensive systems, you can purchase the feed, certainly, which I don't prefer doing because I like being in control of what is going into my animals and the ecosystem that I'm working with. So, I mean, again, we're coming right back to these fodder trees and the silvopasture system in general. We can be using those trees to produce insects. So we can be growing things like the black soldier fly larva is my go-to because it's just so dead simple. They're so easy to work with. They're so forgiving. And the time that the plants are putting on the most production is when the trees are putting on their most production. So why not marry the two? And then if we're growing things like tilapia, for instance, which are herbivores, they love to eat plants. They love the high digestible, high protein mulberry leaves. You grab some of those branches, throw them into the tilapia pond. That can be something as simple as a handful of IBC totes that if you can't put them in the ground, you can always just surround them in some nice, pretty, stained and sealed fence material, right? And so we've got our tilapia ponds in our backyard. It's very easily scalable up. You can have a lined pond or you have a pond that's clay and you set it about 4 foot deep, just flat bottom pond if we're talking about production here. And we line it in trees that'll drop stuff in there to feed our fish, like mulberry trees. They'll like to eat those berries. And we have like soldier fly larva bins set up on the edges of the pond. And we've got our fodder system set up right next to the pond, right? So we can be cutting those leaves, dropping them directly in. We can be putting them in fermentation vessels and then feeding the black soldier fly larva the fermented leaves, and they can be fed for longer. And now we have fish being fed from the photosynthesis of the trees in our essentially a silvopasture system. And boom, now we have free fish yield. That is, it's so dead simple that, you know, we can take a simple net with two people and drag the bottom of that pond a couple times a year if we want to.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just sort the fish out into the sizes that we want to harvest. And so if we're dealing with fish that won't winter kill, like tilapia will for most of the U.S.,
yeah,
then you just drag the net through there and you harvest out some of the bigger catfish, for instance, and you take your harvest yield and they're just eating the bugs.
And we had somebody ask about fish eating mulberry, and catfish are very carnivorous, but they love mulberries. They won't eat the leaves, but they will eat the berries. You want to catch catfish, take you some hot dogs, cut them up in pieces, throw them in a bag, and dump a whole package of cherry or strawberry Jello in there.
Hmm.
And they'll go, well, two things will happen. One, it'll attract them. They go crazy on it. The other thing is it kind of cures it, and it makes it stay on the hook, because hot dog falls off hook really fast. So if they'll eat strawberry Jello, they're going to eat a mulberry.
Yeah, lots of things will eat that stuff.
And like you said, you got the black soldier fly larvae. Well, those can be set up so they self-harvest their ass right into the pond.
Right.
Right. They go straight into the – you don't have to do
straight
anything.
In.
They just go in, and the catfish, they'll eat them. I promise you. Right. I raise catfish in my ponds, and when I throw, like, dehydrated black soldier fly larvae in there, it's piranha level. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Once they figure out what those things are, it's on like Donkey Kong. The other thing is, you can, if you have fish that really prefer not to eat vegetation, mm-hmm. you can have smaller ponds, fill it up with mosquito fish, which is exactly what I do here. Top growth of Azolla. Now the Azolla mm-hmm. can feed the black soldier flies and your ducks.
Right.
And you go through there with a net, whoop, and there's like 1,000 minnows in there in the peak season. And all you do is just pitch them into the larger pond, and nature will take over from there.
Right. Yeah. And to kind of, you know, point this back to the overarching theme of the show of, you know, having this group purchase of land or a communal space, essentially, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be a group purchase. It can just be a neighborhood coalition.
Sure.
This is something that is scalable from, you know, an urban quarter acre postage stamp lot to thousands of acres. There's absolutely no reason why you can't implement something aquatic in nature on a piece of property like this, even if it's a small pond or a series of small ponds set on each person's own property. And if one person decides to go their own way, no big deal.
Yep.
They just took their own koi pond and went off and did whatever they want to do with it, which is kind of a good point. Let's not fall into the mental trap of thinking that everything we do must make food.
Yeah.
Because
I agree.
Koi are expensive.
And money buys all the food you want.
And if I can raise a whole bunch of really high dollar koi in my backyard, and I can take those and once a year sell them off and use those fiat dollars or Bitcoin, mm-hmm. for instance, and I can take that cash and then go to a farmer that was raising the cattle, I can convert some koi in a backyard into half a beef processed in a freezer.
To reinforce that, 2 years ago, I sold a creamsicle longfin koi on Craigslist for $250. It was about a 30-inch fish. And in David's words, I love yuppies.
Yep.
Because they have more money than brains. Right? I mean, you know, and the other side of it is, well, there's years into that fish to get to that size. It just didn't cost me anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Victory Guards mentioned cherry shrimp. You know, I've got billions of those things. And so that'll feed, you know, your bluegills and stuff like that. And with the multi-pond system, you just tell me what's going to happen, because I know you've seen it. You got a, let's say, 0.1 to 0.2 acre little stock tank pond,
mm-hmm.
and somebody puts some bluegills in there, and they don't put any predatory fish in there. What's that pond going to look like in 2 years?
Oh, just
be tiny.
Yeah, little, just little baby fish, and it's. You're not going to have a healthy ecosystem.
They get stunted and they breed, and you end up with like a billion of them in there that are all, you could mail them with a postage stamp.
Yeah.
You know what? Catfish like to eat the hell out of those, and so do bass. So if you had one little pond and you let it be the stunt growth pond, you have infinite bait fish feed for your predator ponds, right? There's like, because I'm trying to get people to think more like you've been trying to get people to think for the last 5 years, which is, how do I break my dependency, at least my 100% dependency on the feed store?
Right.
How do I produce food for my food? Because that's how nature does it, right?
How do I design an ecosystem instead of saying, well, I want eggs, so I'm going to go buy chickens, and then I'm going to buy the feed to feed the chickens. And so now I have expensive eggs. Let's not do that. Let's think about how can we design a whole ecosystem to
How did your poor ass grandma during the Great Depression feed her chickens?
Right.
Right.
She wasn't going to the feed store. Yeah. She wasn't going to Tractor Supply and paying $25 for 25 pounds of chicken feed.
And if she did buy a 50-pound bag of feed, that lasted her flock of a dozen to half a dozen birds for like 3 months. It was supplemental.
Right.
Truly the meaning of the word.
It was the treats just to get them to come to her when she called them so she could get her hands on them and chop one of their heads off.
Yeah, it really was more a conditioning tool.
Yeah.
Like, this is the chicken candy, and otherwise you got to go make a living for yourself. Mm-hmm. Or they also fed them a lot of scraps. Like, I think one of the things that people have problems with, and it works fine for composting, eventually it breaks down, but when you take, like, all your vegetable waste and you throw it out for chickens, they'll pick through it and all. They don't eat much of it because it's not really in a form that they're really keen on eating. But, like, what my grandma used to do is take all that stuff and throw it in a pot and throw it on the coal stove and cook it down to a mush. And then her chickens ate the hell out of that, which was just crazy to me as a kid. Like, why don't they eat the leftover pieces of celery and stuff? Well, they don't want it.
Right.
They want it to break down. So you're just using thermal energy to accelerate the breakdown. Mm-hmm. And that's how most of the chickens that were fed during the Depression, like especially like urban and suburban chickens, they were fed on slop, basically. They did the same thing with pigs. Exact same thing that they did with pigs.
That's what I tell people. Our system that has worked very, very well for us for years is everything that can turn into dirt goes into a bucket in the kitchen. Everything.
Yeah.
We cook some bacon in a pan, in a cast iron skillet. You save the essential oils because we're an essential oil family. The bacon grease goes in a mason jar, right?
Yep.
And then you've got all the black crusty stuff, the carbonized bits that are stuck to the bottom of that cast iron. Well, you use a metal spatula and you scrape it clean. You don't want that stuff going in your bacon grease jar.
No.
You use a paper towel. You wipe it out. Are the birds going to eat that paper towel with the bacon grease on it? Nope.
Not initially.
But can it turn into dirt?
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Everything goes in the bucket and it ends up kind of almost fermenting by the end of the day. It's starting to ferment and that goes into a slop pan out in the chicken barn.
Yep.
And they'll pick through it. And then some of the stuff they wouldn't otherwise eat, by the next day, by the next bucket going in there, it's broken down enough that they'll eat it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have very little waste that way.
It is like chickens were the choice animal of the poor until after World War II. Now chickens are like treated like Pomeranians or something. Like there's that one chicken farm for them, backyard chickens or something like that. And chicken diapers and little suits for them to wear. And it's a bird, man. Let it be a bird. Teacup chickens, bro. That's not what we need. Anyway, this has been good. Let's run through. We got a bunch of questions, so let's lightning round these. And any of them you want to pass to me, you go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to let you go first on them. Tim says, which is preferred, high canopy versus low canopy silvopasture, or is it a depends?
I think there's – you need to have both. I would like, ideally, on a macro scale – larger pasture system, I'd like to see some large overstory canopy, white oaks, persimmon, things like that, that will be growing and dropping mast long term. I'd like to see that there, but I would also like to see some of the lower canopy that we're harvesting the leaf yield off of that every year. And so, yeah, both of those, I think are ideal, but you can go with one or the other just depending on your management preferences and abilities.
Okay, I would agree with that. I got nothing to add. Hack My Homestead, we know who that is, says, is the shade effect of greening area more due to UV impact on microbiology or transpiration of topsoil temp, or is it all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I think the especially in more brittle ecosystems where the soil is drying out a lot more, you're getting a little bit of transpiration drop. So you're getting almost like a little misting of moisture from that tree into the root zone area. It's staying cooler. It's staying more moist. And so you're going to see more fungal activity in there, which is going to greatly impact the microbiology. So I think it's a lot of all of those. But especially like at your place, Jack, and I know you'd agree with me, a lot of it has to do with the temperature.
It's straight up temperature here. There's a lot of other synergistic effects in other locations. For me, I got the deepest soil I got is 10 inches. And I've got places where it's 4. And it's sitting on rock. And it doesn't matter. Like, this was one of the wettest years we've had. And the growth was insane. And it's already starting to brown up anywhere that it's not protected. Because there's only so much reservoir you have in those shallow, brittle soils. And for people that don't know me, when I say shallow soil, I'm not talking about shallow fertile soil layers with like a big, you know, subsoil. I'm saying it's rock, not rocks. It's slab.
No, he's saying this is how much dirt he has.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
He's not exaggerating.
That's it. And it's very difficult. And my response to that, though, is if what I can do here works as well as it does, you do these same things in a place that it can be down the road 5 miles. Just, you know, their rock layer is 4 foot deep. Nothing dies. Everything makes it through. Even our harsh summers, everything makes it through. If you do it the way that we're talking about, moving on so we don't take too long here because we're already long. Josh says, what is the cost effective way to protect young trees from sheep and cattle that will be rotating around my pastures? Electro wire.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I would do, Josh, is if you have those trees in, especially, I don't like straight lines all over the place, but straight lines make management very easy. So if you are incorporating these trees into a system, trying to manage a single tree in the middle of nowhere and protect it is going to be expensive. So what I would suggest would be laneways of trees, rows of trees, or blocks of trees.
Mm-hmm.
So either have a 25-foot square block that is fenced with electric or, you know, just a physical barrier fence, and you keep the trees in there, and you end up making a little bit of a reverse glade, if you will, an island of overstory trees.
Yeah.
Okay? So you've got a cluster of trees. You've got a mix of species in there, big overstory oaks and chestnuts and things like that that will get, and persimmons that'll get really big and tall. And you have the smaller trees kind of as the edge. You've got your white mulberries right on the very edge where you're going to be pollarding them and topping them back. So you can do that as kind of, you know, a 25-foot circle or square. You can do, you know, 100-foot circle or square, depending on the scale that you're working with. But also, any of your fence lines can be planted to those trees. And what you're going to end up is you're going to end up with a little bit of a tiresome kind of teenage phase where that edge gets really productive and really weedy. But as it matures and grows in, you're going to have a very shady fence line. And that shady fence row is going to be very, very easy to maintain because there's going to be almost no weed pressure and your animals are going to want to go right up to that fence. And then the nice thing is once you have that in place, let's say this is a perimeter fence or a permanent subdivision fence, your trees are on one side of that. You can put temporary fence on the other side of that, and then, you know, a handful, you know, two or three strands of electric, give it enough space, and then you can protect that row very cheaply and easily because it's just a straight shot. And then
that'll really work on smaller pieces of land. I mean, really.
Right.
On bigger land, if you want to keep the cost down if you use like the electro tape and step in stakes,
yep,
it's a little bit more of an investment initially, but it's not much because the tape and the stakes are not what's expensive. The charger is where the money is. So if you have enough electro tape and step ins to do two paddocks,
mm-hmm.
then every morning you can come out and open one paddock to the other. Everybody's going to run to the ice cream. You put yep. that one back, and then you deconstruct the one behind it and put it in front. So you're moving the tape that you've disconnected so you don't zap your ass, because you will if you don't do that. You're moving it while they're contained and occupied.
Correct.
Right. It'd be great if you could just have the whole thing set up and you just are opening a gate each day. Mm-hmm. But that could be very expensive over time. Where if you're just moving, let's say you're grazing a quarter acre a day on a small group of animals,
right.
it's not much. It's probably just no more time than it takes me to fill my duck ponds in the morning.
Right.
Like, it's not a big job. And yeah. that'll protect your trees until they can actually become mm-hmm. those fence posts. And then we can run permanent electro wire, and then we can literally just move them in a cell every day. But that right. would be a right. cheap way to get there, in my opinion.
Yeah, and then if you're going more macro on a larger scale, then oftentimes it is actually more cost effective to just go ahead and put up, you know, four strands of high tensile electric in a circle or a rectangle yeah. around a cluster of trees and yep. leave that there for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yep.
And then once the trees are big enough, you just remove it. And now you have yep. a shady area for them to go, and they'll drop manure there and feed those trees.
Yep, absolutely. 80 acres, high prairie, will have cattle on it till fall. He has tumbleweed, cheatgrass. Opinion on a controlled burn before planting trees?
Yeah, I think controlled burns are great. They're a natural prairie ecosystem event. A lot of those native grasses and forbs benefit greatly from controlled burns. So I think there's a 100% a good place for those in those kinds of ecosystems, in a lot of ecosystems, really.
Be careful.
Yeah. Just
make sure controlled is actually the right adjective.
Right. Know what you're doing. Yeah. Know the environmental conditions. If there's high winds, don't even think about it. And you might want to bring in somebody or bring in your local fire department or bring in a professional to handle that for the first time and learn about it before you attempt to do it by yourself.
Awesome. Builder said, so you get your lambs to drop in the spring and you butcher them in the fall. Yes.
Yep.
Right. I mean, that's pretty simple on there. Yes.
Or spring and you butcher them in the summer.
Yep. Yep. Question, how much mulch is the right amount? It depends. Can there be too much putting trees in a former lawn, remembering to avoid the tree volcanoes?
Yeah. Okay. So this is what I always tell my clients. You have a built-in gauge and system right here. Here's your tree. These are the roots. The fingers are the roots. The hand is the root crown. It's going to swell out. And then above that is the trunk, right? I want to see the root, the soil line right here. Below the swelling and above the roots. I don't want any dirt above that. I don't want dirt below that. Air below that, right?
Yeah.
So that's
yep.
my soil level. When I'm planting that tree, I want to be able to see a little bit of a donut. Even if it's just half an inch of dirt. I want to be able to see the dirt in between the mulch and the wood of the trunk. If I can see that, I don't care how tall the mulch comes up from there.
Yep.
As long as I can see dirt and I'm not burying the crown of that tree in mulch, whatever that angle of repose, that resting angle is with whatever kind of mulch you're using,
yeah.
make sure you're not piling up too tall that it's going to just fall down or your chickens are going to scratch it down on top of the tree.
Yeah.
Make sure that's sloped away. But, I mean, you can have the mulch come out 3 feet deep, 4 or 5 feet away from that tree,
not up against the trunk, and you can see the flare, and you'll know who I'm channeling here. I want to see that flare dramatically come off that tree. If it looks like a telephone pole, you're wrong, and your tree is going to die. You know dirt exactly doctor. Who I'm channeling, a dirt doctor, right? A dramatic Ric Flair. Uh-huh. You can have a pawn shop and get yourself one of them golf clubs, a cheap one, break the head off and aerate the root zone, and do the full sick tree treatment, right? But if you do what Nick's telling you, you won't have to do the sick tree treatment, right? But yeah. One of the things people need to understand is if you expose root, it will bark over. But if you rot bark, it will not become root. It will begin a death process. And when you pile mulch up against the trunk of the tree, it's only a matter of time until you kill the tree.
Right.
Right. And the volcanoes, that's a Texas thing. I've never seen that anywhere else where they have the pile of mulch up against
the trunk of the tree. I've seen it all over the USA.
Really?
Yes.
It's so stupid. You have to know nothing about trees to do that.
Yep. And one of the most important things to understand when you're planting these trees like that is, guys, if you're buying something from a big box store, this blew the minds of most people when I was at Nicole's for teaching the food forest workshop, that small orchard food forestry workshop.
Yep.
Last year or the year before, I can't remember. People were blown away. We took the trees out of their pots and we rinsed them off and we pulled the roots down and we exposed the crown of the tree that was sometimes 4 inches
sticking
below the surface of that soil in there.
Yep.
And they thought we're just going to kill all the trees.
Yeah, because what the experts say is make sure you don't bury the graft. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're right up to the graft, you've buried the whole root flare. Yeah. I would say 98%. I don't think it's an exaggeration of trees that come in a bucket are planted too deep in the bucket that they're in. And if you don't get that dirt off, and if you don't do what you said, I do the same thing you do. I rinse all the dirt off the roots. I turn it into a bare root and I pull those roots out.
That's
because
right.
if you That's don't, right. you've got those circling roots that will eventually girdle the trunk and it will strangle itself.
Yep.
And I've had landscapers tell me, all you have to do is just chop the edges of the root ball with a machete. And I'm like, well, if you're a landscaper and you get paid to put a new tree in every 10 years, I guess that's a good strategy.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, if you're planting one Karen tree in the front of the suburbs and you want more work in the future, that's a good strategy. But if you're trying to plant a forest and you want to maintain it for generations, it's probably not. Real quick, Anarchy, thanks for sort of the super chat, and you're welcome for the advice.
Appreciate it.
Victory Garden says, my best combo, though, when I went through this myself, was food forest style guilds of mulberry apple, comfrey, blackberries, and sheep, dogs, and bees. Thoughts zone 6. Sounds like he's got a solution, mate. I mean,
yeah, that's pretty much what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
All those same kinds of things.
Bill says, just started a market farm more for the insurance aspect than the money. What plants would work with this type of system? I've thought about setting up rows of comfrey, maybe dandelions for pigs. So it's a market farm, and he's gotten to want to integrate some other things into it.
I don't exactly know what you mean by a market farm for the insurance aspect.
I think he means food insurance. Like, I'm going to sell it, but the real reason is I get food.
Okay. I mean, rows of comfrey are great. I would say all of the, you know, the fodder trees will help out a lot with bringing in a little bit of shade and wind block, little bit of deposition of windborne debris and, you know, insect bits, fertility like that. So, yeah, I
have no problem circumnavigating a freaking market garden with trees, especially like mulberry, willow, things like that. One thing about these trees that you use, Nick, they're not really 100% shade, especially willow. It's more a dappled shade. Right. And like, you know, where I have my garden, I have to, with the sun trying to kill me 3 months of the year, it's all dappled shade. Every bit of it's either dappled shade or it has a few hours of shade every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a dramatic difference in the places that get baked harder than the ones that don't. So I would say you'd improve everything with some shade, not too much shade.
Yeah,
and then as that comes in, you also can be like, oh, that spot's actually really shady. And so that's where all my greens are going to go in the warm months of the year when they're tending to bolt on me.
Right. And even if you're realizing, hey, this is a little bit too shady, I want to thin it out. Well, you just pollard it. You just take those branches as a harvest, as a yield, and feed them to your animals, and then utilize the leftover wood for your fuel wood and biochar.
Triple's asking about Muscovy mules. For those who don't know, that just means you've taken a standard mallard breed duck, like a Welsh Harlequin or a Saxony, and you've bred it with a Muscovy. And that can go either way, Drake Muscovy to hen duck, Drake duck to hen Muscovy. They get hybrid vigor. They grow really big. They taste like a Muscovy more than a regular duck, and they're sterile, so they don't reproduce. I've had some here, but it's always been just – it just happens. I don't do it on purpose.
Yeah, I don't think they're a high incidence of crossing when they're breeding. I think it's a more rare thing. It's not like every time you cross a horse and a donkey, you get a mule.
Yeah.
I think it's more of like a, oh, that's interesting. You got one to actually hatch.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say, if you take a Muscovy Drake and you stick him in a group of ducks, he will breed the hell out of them. If he has no other option, if he don't get some duck loving, he's going to find some.
Oh, sure.
And there are like D'Artagnan actually markets, mullards is what they call them.
Okay.
But it has to be an intentional thing to get in any quantity. Bill has two questions. I'll give him rate it once because I think one's real simple. Can elderberry be used as feed? And he also says, is that the mulberry that you sell, Nick? Now, he's talking about a Hicks everberry.
Okay, so can elderberry be fed? Yes and no. I generally tell people, try and stay away from the elderberry as a feed. There are some concerns with alkaloids, I believe, in the leaves. There are some toxins in the leaves that, depending on the species and the timing and everything, it can be a problem. I've never been worried about it with my animals just browsing on them, but I would not go out of my way to raise elderberry for like a feed inclusion. I grow them for the flowers to make, elderflower syrup and liqueur. And I grow them for the berries to make elderberry jelly and wines and stuff.
And
basically as a medicine.
Fantastic mead as well. Elderberry mead is pretty fantastic.
Oh yeah.
Next, on the
mulberry, no, I do not have the Hicks everbearing yet. But I'm working on something exciting that I don't want to talk about just yet. But that is very likely to be an offering in a lot higher quantity than I thought I was going to be able to do here soon.
Because when you start out with a couple, it takes a while before you have enough to be selling it off. Like if you have three heifers, you ain't selling no heifers before you get some calves, right? You got to build up your herd, so to say. Family Driven says, have you laid any mulberry like a hedge?
I have,
but not intentionally, because I've got that dwarf everberry mulberry, and they just turn into hedges.
Yep. I have. The problem with using it as a livestock retention or detention hedge
they
like to eat it, and they will strip the bark off of it. Sheep and goats both will strip the bark off of it. So it's not a fantastic hedge when it comes to keeping livestock contained.
No, you want Osage Orange for that.
Yep.
Yeah, Osage Orange will do it because it stabs the hell out of you and it grows like crazy. And they only eat that. I've never said, well, let me be careful. I'm not saying cattle won't eat the big globule orange things that aren't really an orange. They look like a giant green grapefruit. And the problem with that is I've seen cattle eat so many of them, they get impacted. Like, you know, Nick said sheep try to kill themselves. Well, there's certain times a year in certain situations where cattle decide to act like sheep. One is huge mass drop of hide cannon acorn. I've seen cattle near kill themselves with that. I've seen them near kill themselves with Osage orange. I can't think of it. I'm sure there's something else. I haven't seen cattle like go suicidal on anything but those two things.
Right.
Okay. Bill says, how much fertility and water do mulberry need?
Well, they're very, very hardy. So, I mean, they'll grow wild just about all over the USA. So they don't need high fertility and water. But like with any tree, if you want to get the most production out of them, give them some fertility and water and keep them in an optimal soil condition to get the most out of them.
And I will say they do need a significant amount of moisture. But I would say, you know what? They're one of my more drought tolerant species right here. And it's tough to survive a drought here.
Yeah.
So how old is the tree? The deeper those roots go, the more, and how long have you been using good like earthworks and management practices to infiltrate your water? Because if you have water infiltrated down 18 foot, there's almost not a tree that can't survive 3 months without rain at that point.
Like mm-hmm.
once it's chased that water down, it's pretty damn stable. That's it. Hey man, I appreciate you being with me today. This turned into a marathon, but I think it was a good marathon.
Awesome.
Well, again, I appreciate you being with me today, Nick. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me out.
All right. Well, real quick before I wrap up, let's go ahead and close down and talk a little bit about how you can help support this show. One way is to do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. And no matter what you buy, if you start your shopping there, you'll help us out. Today's item of the day is the same item of the day I had yesterday because it's still on sale. I put these out last year, did a lot of stuff on meat cutting, trimming fat, butchering. And this particular model, which is the Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife, which if you talk to professional meat cutters, it is the number one tool that they reach for on a daily basis. Well, I sold there was one vendor on Amazon selling these, and I sold out his whole inventory. And when they came back, even though they retail for like $30, they were selling for like $40. Well, they finally come down to a price that makes sense again, about $23-24. If you do not have one of these in your kitchen, I hate to put it this way, but you're wrong. And you probably should have one of these in your kitchen because they're just so dadgone versatile. Think of them like a fish fillet knife for everything, for your chickens, your deep boning chicken, trimming fat off chicken thighs, breaking down primals like strip loins and whole ribeye loins and things like that. They're just a fantastic knife, and they're very inexpensive. And somebody had mentioned yesterday, mine have never seen a stone except one time when Patrick Rohrman was here, because if Patrick Rohrman wants to sharpen your knives for you, you give them to him. These are, because of the thin profile of steel and all, they are very easy to keep scalpel sharp with just a steel. And that is one really advantageous thing about them. So definitely think about that. Think about joining the MSB to help us out, because that really helps us out. 18 cents an episode. We've been running a sale. I don't care if your dog ate your discount code. I ran a sale for 3 weeks. It's over. Anybody that emailed me this morning and it expired last night at midnight, and that means maybe you're on the East Coast or something, I honored the sale price for the people that emailed me this morning about it. It's done for a while. When I say a sale ends, I mean it ends. But it's still a good deal. Again, 18 cents an episode. And also think about taking some of our courses at homefoodsystems.com. One thing I think a lot of people aren't aware of, I have a full-on, four-hour-long permaculture principle-based design course. It is free. You can go take that course right now. All you got to do is register on the site. There's no tricks. You take that course for free. I have the bioreactor composting course. It's $40. I am 50% done with the production of the cover crop course. Now that doesn't mean as little as it sounds. When I say 50% done, I mean with the production side. It took me 2.5 months to put together the curriculum and the coursework for this course. It's going to be one of the best things I've ever done. That hopefully will be available by the end of the month. And it's probably going to sell for about $80. So that'll be coming soon. If you take any of the courses there, you'll definitely know when the other ones become available. I thank you all for tuning in today. It's one of the longer, not the longest, but one of the longer episodes we've done at over 2 hours and 20 minutes. I thank Nick Ferguson for sitting in with us today to do this. It's kind of just an impromptu one. I appreciate all of you who showed up for the live stream, all of you that asked some really great questions today, and I will catch you tomorrow with another episode. Since we did an interview today, tomorrow will be just Jack. Take care, guys.
Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.